This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio from Monday, March 18, 2024. The Supreme Court hears a case about how far the government can lobby or pressure social media companies to remove content considered false or dangerous before it crosses the line into unconstitutional coercion. The case arose from the Biden administration's efforts to tamp down anti-COVID-19 vaccine and stolen 2020 presidential election misinformation. Supreme Court hears a second case today about the First Amendment challenging New York State's guidance that financial institutions should not be doing business with the National Rifle Association, the NRA. President Joe Biden calls for $12 billion in new funding for women's health research in a Women's History Month celebration at the White House. He also signs an executive order to advance the study of women's health, including strengthening data collection. Disputes over border security funding and policy reportedly holding up a final agreement on government funding for six annual appropriations bills whose current funding expires Friday. We will hear from NBC congressional reporter Scott Wong about the chances of a partial government shutdown. White House says President Biden spoke to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and the Prime Minister has agreed to send a delegation to Washington to talk about the Biden administration's concerns over Israel's planned invasion of the Gaza city of Rafah in its continuing war against Hamas. We also hear the White House reaction to Russian President Vladimir Putin's re-election victory and his claims that now-deceased Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny could have been released in a prisoner swap. Plus the latest from the State Department about helping Americans escape gang violence in Haiti. From the Associated Press, the Supreme Court seemed likely Monday to side with the Biden administration in a dispute with Republican-led states over how far the federal government can go to combat controversial social media posts on topics including COVID-19 and election security. The justices seemed broadly skeptical during nearly 2 hours of arguments that a lawyer for Louisiana, Missouri, and other parties presented, accusing officials in the Democratic administration of leaning on the social media platforms to unconstitutionally squelch conservative points of view. Lower courts have sided with the states, but the Supreme Court blocked those rulings while it considers the issue. Several justices said they were concerned that common interactions between government officials and the platforms could be affected by a ruling for the states. That was reporting from Associated Press. Here is some of the Supreme Court oral argument in the case Murthy v. Missouri. Justice Samuel Alito questioning U.S. Principal Deputy Solicitor General Brian Fletcher, who defended the federal government's actions.
Mr. Fletcher, when I read all of the emails exchanged between the White House and other federal officials and Facebook in particular, but also some of the other platforms, and I see that the White House and federal officials are repeatedly saying that Facebook and the federal government should be partners, we're on the same team. Officials are demanding answers. I want an answer. I want it right away. When they're unhappy, they curse them out. There are regular meetings. There is constant pestering of Facebook and some of the other platforms, and they want to have regular meetings, and they suggest, they suggest rules that should be applied, and why don't you tell us everything that you're going to do so we can help you and we can look it over. And I thought, wow, I cannot imagine federal officials taking that approach to the print media, our representatives over there. If you did that to them, what do you think the reaction would be? And so I thought, you know, the only reason why this is taking place is because the federal government has got Section 230 and antitrust in its pocket, and it's, to mix my metaphors, and it's got these big clubs available to it. And so it's treating Facebook and these other platforms like they're subordinates. Would you do that to the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Associated Press or any other big newspaper or wire service?
So there's a lot packed in there. I want to give you one very specific answer first and then step back out to the broader context. So specifically, you mentioned demanding an answer right away and cursing them out. The only time that happens is in an email that's about the president's own Instagram account. It's not about moderating other people's
content. Okay, we'll put that aside. There's all the rest. So, constant meetings, constant emails. We want answers.
Right.
We're partners. We're on the same team. You think that the print media regards themselves as being on the same team as the federal government, partners with the federal government?
So potentially in the context of an effort to get Americans vaccinated during a once-in-a-lifetime pandemic. And I really think that piece of context, it doesn't change the First Amendment principles, but it's relevant to how they apply here. And I think it's important to understand that at this time, this was a time when thousands of Americans were still dying every week, and there was a hope that getting everyone vaccinated could stop the pandemic. And there was a concern that Americans were getting their news about the vaccine from these platforms, and the platforms were promoting, not just posting,
well,
but promoting bad information.
I understand all that, and I know the objectives were good. But once again, they were also getting their news from the print media and the broadcast media and cable media, and I just can't imagine the federal government doing that to them. But maybe I'm naive. Maybe that goes on behind the scenes. I don't. But I it struck me as, wow, this is not what I understand the relationship to be. That's all.
But I do. I think this is important because I have the same reaction that you do, that these emails look unusual. I think the idea that there'd be back and forth between the government and the media isn't unusual at all. When the White House press secretary on July 16th is asked about this by the press at the time, what she says is, of course we talk to the platforms just the way we talk to all of you when we have concerns about what you're doing, when we have information that you might find helpful. Now, there's an intensity of the back and forth here, and there's an anger that I think is unusual. But the context for that, I think, is that these platforms were saying publicly, we want to help. We think we have a responsibility to give people accurate information and not bad information. And we're doing everything we can to meet that goal. That's where this language of partnership comes from. It's not just from the White House. It's these platforms, which are powerful, sophisticated entities, saying we're doing the best we can. And the anger, I think really most of the anger when you read the emails, and I appreciate that you have, because I think you have to look at them in context. The anger is when the officials think that the platforms are not being transparent about the scope of the problem, or aren't giving information that's available.
Brian Fletcher is U.S. Principal Deputy Solicitor General, questioned by Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito in today's oral argument in the case Murthy v. Missouri. Louisiana Solicitor General Benjamin Aguinaga argued on behalf of his state and Missouri. Here questioned by Justice Elena Kagan, who, along with Justice Brett Kavanaugh, who briefly interjects in this portion of the oral argument, previously served as White House lawyers.
It seems like an extremely expansive argument, I must say, encouraging people basically to suppress their own speech. So, and like Justice Kavanaugh, I've had some experience encouraging press to suppress their own speech. You just wrote a bad editorial. Here are the five reasons you shouldn't write another one. You just wrote a story that's filled with factual errors. Here are the 10 reasons why you shouldn't do that again. I mean, this happens literally thousands of times a day in the federal government.
Yeah, and I would say in the Meinhorn case that you're describing to me, it's the government going after the speaker itself and trying to get them to change their speech. What's so pernicious here is that you don't see any of these facts in this record unless we get discovery, which is when Rob Flaherty, who's deputy assistant to the president, sends an email to Facebook or to Twitter and complains that they're not doing enough to censor what they view as vaccine hesitancy speech. America never sees that. And the third party, people like Jill Hines and Jim Hoft, whose speech wishes to express the kinds of viewpoints that the White House is targeting, they never know that that's happening behind the scenes. And I think it makes a difference, Justice Kagan, that you have an intermediary here who really has no incentive to itself defend Jim Hoft's speech or to defend Jill Hines' speech. In the New York Times hypothetical, you have a storied publication that itself is familiar with those kinds of
things. What about op-eds? What about op-eds?
Your Honor, and with op-eds, you know, if it's a third-party speech that it's...
That happens too, right?
And I guess there are a number of ways I would think about that, Your Honor. One is, if the newspaper declines to run an op-ed because the government asked, that op-ed author can go to any number of other publications and it has an outlet. It's not the same here, because if I'm on Twitter and I wish to express a viewpoint that the government wishes to censor and Twitter bows to that pressure, then
I was just going to say, first, I have no experience coercing anybody.
Chief Justice John Roberts, and before that, Louisiana Solicitor General Benjamin Aguinaga, questioned by Justice Elena Kagan. You heard briefly from Justice Brett Kavanaugh. The case today, Murthy v. Missouri. New York Times article has this: the court this term has repeatedly grappled with fundamental questions about the scope of the government's authority over major technology platforms. On Friday, the court set rules for when government officials can block users from their private social media accounts. Last month, the court considered the constitutionality of laws in Florida and Texas that limit large social media companies from making editorial judgments about which messages to allow. Those four cases, along with the one on Monday, will collectively rebalance the power of the government and powerful technology platforms in the realm of free speech. That from the New York Times. Supreme Court heard a second case today, NRA v. Bulo. Reuters reports the case is whether a New York State official can be sued for violating the National Rifle Association's constitutional free speech rights by allegedly pressuring banks and insurers to avoid doing business with the influential group due to its gun rights advocacy. The lawyer for the NRA was David Cole, National Legal Director for the ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson asking the questions here. She'll refer to Bantam Books. That's a 1963 Supreme Court decision that challenged Rhode Island's threatening booksellers who sold what was deemed then obscene material.
You have to show that there's coercion, and you allege that. But you also have to show that that coercion resulted in a First Amendment violation. The Bantam Books is saying you can't do indirectly what you can't, right? What you can't do directly. But the direct thing in Bantam Books was a prior restraint. This here doesn't look like a prior restraint. So what is your, this is sort of Justice Thomas's question again, right? What is your theory of the First Amendment?
Again, it's the same answer as to Justice Thomas. The First Amendment, of course, the First Amendment prohibits absolute censorship or suppression of speech, but it also prohibits the imposition of any burden on speech because of its content. Even if the government denies a contract to an entity because it disapproves of what that entity says.
Right, but isn't the hard part figuring out whether the burden is being imposed because of the content of the speech or because of the conduct?
Well,
So that's why we have to be really careful about what you're alleging is the First Amendment problem, because the government can regulate conduct. Correct?
I agree. And if this was a case in which the government had said, you know, the NRA is violating the law left and right, and we have to respond to that, and here are the legal obligations, that would be one thing. That is not what they said. They said, we want to shut the NRA down. We want to put the gun lobby out of business. The title of the guidance letters that she issues are guidance regarding the NRA and other gun promotion organizations. The whole guidance is saying, I don't like the fact that people use guns. I don't like the fact that people advocate for the use of guns.
David Cole is ACLU National Legal Director, arguing before the Supreme Court, and the questions from Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, the case NRA v. Bulo. As always, you can find the full oral argument of all the Supreme Court cases at our website, cspan.org. Supreme Court today declined to hear the appeal of the founder of Cowboys for Trump, who was convicted over his role in the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol and then lost his job as a county commissioner in New Mexico, based on Section 3 of the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, which says people in office who took an oath to defend the Constitution, then engage in insurrection, can't hold office again. In a similar case, when the Supreme Court ruled recently for Donald Trump and kept him on the Colorado presidential primary ballot, the justice said then that ruling only applies to those running for federal office. This is Washington Today. Story from CNN, President Joe Biden is taking new executive action Monday to improve research on women's health across the federal government, as well as announce new actions being taken by several federal agencies as the White House seeks to increase funding for women's health research. The president signed the order at the White House as part of a Women's History Month celebration, joined by First Lady Jill Biden, Vice President Kamala Harris, and Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff, and Maria Shriver, former First Lady of California, a journalist, author, and founder of the Women's Alzheimer's Movement.
You can just close your eyes and imagine the history that has been made here. You can see it on the walls, you can see it everywhere, you can feel it when you walk in. But today is a day to keep your eyes wide open, because you, my friends, are about to watch history get made. For the first time ever in our nation, a president, that guy right there, he is going to sign an executive order that will transform the way our federal government deals with women's health. This executive order will direct the most comprehensive set of executive actions ever taken to ensure that women's health gets integrated and prioritized across all federal agencies. It will galvanize new research on a wide range of topics and help prevent, diagnose, and treat women's health conditions once and for all. I also wager, and I'm not even a betting woman, but I'll bet today, that this is the first time a president of the United States has ever signed an executive order that mentions the words menopause and women's and women's midlife health in it. With the stroke of his pen, women will get the answers and the care they have long sought and they so rightly deserve.
Maria Shriver, former First Lady of California, journalist, author, women's health advocate, today at the White House, part of a Women's History Month celebration. President Biden calling on Congress to approve $12 billion for women's health research.
We've launched the first ever White House initiative in women's health research to pioneer the next generation of scientific research and discovery in women's health. Think of all the breakthroughs we've made in medicine across the board, but women have not been the focus. Research has been taking much too long to get to y'all. I've called on Congress, as we've said, I'm repeating myself here, $12 billion for that effort. And today we're jump-starting that investment by dedicating $200 million in National Institute of Health to tackle some of the most pressing health problems facing women today. With the executive order I'm about to sign, I'm directing the most comprehensive set of executive actions ever taken to improve women's health, ever taken. And I'm going to ensure that women's health is integrated and prioritized across the entire federal government. It's not just in women's health, not just at NIH, the National Science Foundation, the Defense Department, the Environmental Protection Agency. I mean, across the board, this is really serious. And I will spearhead new research and innovation for breakthroughs in a wide range of women's health needs and that they experience throughout you experience throughout your lives. Because it really matters. It matters. Because we're focused on supporting women together, our administration has turned around the economy. Because we focused on women, by the way. Focused on women. We've achieved the lowest unemployment rate for women in 70 years. More women, especially mothers, in the workforce than ever before. The narrowest gender gap on record, but so much more to do, so much more to do.
President Biden at the White House. U.S. House and Senate are not in session today. Friday is the deadline to pass the six remaining fiscal year 2024 appropriations bills to prevent a partial federal government shutdown. Those bills fund the Departments of Defense, Homeland Security, Health and Human Services, Education, and State, along with the IRS, General Government, and Foreign Operations. C-SPAN spoke with Scott Wong, NBC News Senior Congressional Reporter.
Another week, another shutdown. We have just 5 days now to avert this latest shutdown threat. This is the second tranche of funding. You remember they passed an earlier tranche that funded, that passed six bills in that package funding various agencies. This is a more critical package because it deals with the Pentagon. It deals with the Homeland Security Department. It deals with the State Department, really critical agencies that are necessary for the federal government. And so over the weekend, there was some developments. We had gone into the weekend thinking that they were very close on about five of those critical bills, but still running into problems on the Homeland Security front, which has vexed this Congress, for a year and a half now. Because of issues with border security, because of the migrant crisis. And so a real, distance between the two sides when it comes to Homeland Security. But what we have learned from some reporting in Politico and others is that over the weekend they had decided, we're not going to do a CR, we're not going to do a short-term funding bill for the Homeland Security Agency. We're going to try to include Homeland as part of this larger six appropriation bill package. As we stand now, it looks like it's moving forward. However, we have yet to see legislative text. That is a critical thing that we need to see in order to avert that shutdown by that Friday night deadline.
You talk about when we're going to see legislative text. What is the timeline here for that to happen? And aren't there certain amounts of time that the text has to be out there for senators and the general public to read before they can actually vote on these things? Aren't there rules on that?
Exactly. We had hoped that we were going to see legislative text by Sunday night. However, that didn't happen. We're now here Monday morning. Because Speaker Johnson has said they will abide by the 72-hour rule, which essentially means, they introduce the legislation, three legislative days pass before they will hold a vote on it. That puts us at about Wednesday. This seems to be getting delayed and delayed further, as we head into this week. And so because it takes the Senate at least a couple days to sort of process a House vote, that's going to put us very close to that Friday night deadline. What it means is that it's possible, I'm just putting this out there, it's possible we will have to have another short-term stopgap measure known that we call in this town a CR in order to sort of, bridge that time. We could have a very, very short-term CR needed heading into the weekend, or unless all 100 senators agree to have a very, very rapid vote.
Scott Wong, NBC News senior congressional reporter on C-SPAN's Washington Journal program this morning. USA Today article adds the main conflicts with the final spending deal lie within Homeland Security due to broad disagreements over border security funding and immigration policy. House Republicans last year called for a sweeping hardline border deal, but the Senate has taken different approaches in recent months, and lawmakers have failed to coalesce around a solution to address the crisis at the southern border. That was from USA Today. The White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre asked at her news conference about the status of the funding bills, particularly Homeland Security, and the possibility of a partial government shutdown.
Why don't the White House object to plans that were taking shape over the weekend for the Homeland Security budget? And what do you want to make sure gets included in the final legislation? How close are you at this point, do you think?
Look, I'm not going to talk about reporting regarding ongoing negotiations. Going to be super careful talking from the podium here. One thing that I will make clear is that DHS needs a bill that adequately funds operational pace, right? And we have seen during this past fiscal year, and that is what the administration is fighting for. We want to make sure that they have the operational funding to do the job that they need to be doing. And that is what I can say. And I want to also add is, let's not forget the past 10 months here. DHS has removed and returned more people than during every fiscal year since 2013. So they have maximized their operations. They have done the work to do what they can. At the funding levels that they currently are operating in, and we want to do everything that we can to make sure that they have that operational pace. So I'm not going to get into negotiations from here.
So it sounds like we're talking about the issue is a dollar figure. The White House wants more money than being offered.
Just going to be super mindful and not negotiate from the podium. But obviously, we believe that DHS needs additional funding. We've always said that to deal with the security operations and much more that we're dealing with at the border, obviously, and just more broadly, all the work that the DHS has to do on behalf of the American people. Negotiations continue, and we are focused certainly on reaching an agreement. As you know, the shutdown is set for this coming Friday, and we want to get to a place where we have, again, DHS has what it needs to have the operational, continue the operational pace that they've been having.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre with reporters in the White House briefing room. The House Freedom Caucus posting on X, HFC Chairman Bob Good, Republican from Virginia, and Congressman Chip Roy, Republican from Texas, led 41 fellow Republicans in urging the House Republican Conference to use the power of the purse in this week's government funding bill to dismantle Biden's disastrous open border policies. Otherwise, Republicans will be actively funding this crisis. That from the House Freedom Caucus. On Wall Street today, the Dow up 75, NASDAQ up 130, S&P up 32. Story from Axios, the Environmental Protection Agency on Monday announced a ban on the last form of asbestos still used in the United States. The carcinogen is linked to more than 40,000 deaths per year in the U.S., and chrysotile asbestos is still used in certain types of gaskets, car brakes, and other materials per the EPA. The import of this asbestos is banned immediately, but fully phasing out could take anywhere from 6 months to 12 years in some sectors. That from Axios. Washington Today continues in a moment.
Hi, I'm Tammy, and joining me today is Paul, as we celebrate 45 years of C-SPAN's unblinking eye on the democratic process.
That's right, Tammy. Since our founding in 1979, C-SPAN has been documenting history with a unique approach, unfiltered, without commentary, and entirely independent from government funding. C-SPAN is funded by fees from our cable and satellite distribution partners, and now with fewer people subscribing to cable and satellite, we're asking you to help support our next 45 years.
It's amazing to see how C-SPAN has adapted and grown. With the rise of digital platforms and social media, C-SPAN has expanded its reach, so no matter where you are, you have 24/7, 365 access to the democratic process.
And as we navigate this ever-changing media environment, C-SPAN's dedication to putting you in the rooms where politics is debated and policy is determined will not waver.
We ask you to support C-SPAN's vital mission. As we celebrate 45 years of service, your contribution helps us to continue to adapt and grow in this digital age. Visit cspan.org/donate to make your contribution today.
Here's to 45 more years of bringing democracy directly to you wherever you get your news. Thank you for your support. Visit cspan.org/donate today to make a difference.
Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast, wherever you find your podcasts, and on the C-SPAN Now mobile app, which is free. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, writes ABC News on Monday, agreed to send a team of Israeli officials to Washington to discuss with Biden administration officials a prospective Rafah operation, White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said. The White House has been skeptical of Netanyahu's plan to carry out an operation in the southern city of Rafah, where about 1.5 million displaced Palestinians are sheltering, as Israel looks to eliminate Hamas following Hamas's deadly October 7th attack. The agreement to hold talks about Rafah came as Biden and Netanyahu spoke on Monday, their first interaction in more than a month, as the divide has grown between allies over the food crisis in Gaza and Israel's conduct during the war, according to the White House. Sullivan added that Biden questioned the Israeli leader over a lack of a coherent and sustainable strategy to defeat Hamas. That was reporting from ABC News. Jake Sullivan held a news conference at the White House. He was asked about the call between the leaders and the expected talks in Washington.
Why did the president feel that this was an appropriate time for this delegation to come from Israel? And why did he feel that these conversations would succeed in ways that your outreach to the Israeli government have not previously?
Look, this is the natural evolution of a discussion between partners. We've had many discussions at many different levels between our military, our intelligence, our diplomats, our humanitarian experts, but we have not yet had the opportunity to have an all-encompassing, comprehensive, integrated, strategic discussion about how to achieve two things. One, the ultimate defeat of Hamas, and two, the protection of civilians and the stabilization of Gaza in a way that will lead to the long-term security of Israel, as well as the protection of innocent human life that is in Gaza. So from the president's perspective, we've arrived at a point where each side has been making clear to the other its perspective, its view, and now we really need to get down to brass tacks and have the chance for a delegation from each side on an integrated basis, everyone sitting around the same table, talking through the way forward. And from the U.S. perspective, this is not a question of defeating Hamas. And anytime I hear an argument that says, if you don't smash into Rafah, you can't defeat Hamas, I say that is a straw man. Our view is that there are ways for Israel to prevail in this conflict, to secure its long-term future, to end the terror threat from Gaza and not smash into Rafah. That's what we're going to present in this integrated way when this team comes. We'll have it back and forth, and we'll let you know how that unfolds as we go forward. Yeah.
Can you describe the tone of the call? There have been reports that they can be very tense, that they have ended abruptly. Can you sort of characterize what the tone was? And then also, did the president say that an invasion of Rafah is his red line? And what does that mean?
I went over the red line issue, which I know is the obsession of this group last week. I've got nothing more to say on that front, as you know, particularly for me. I think that's something that is posed in your questions. It's not stated as a declaration of our policy, and we've made that clear. With respect to the call, I'm probably not the best person to, you know, give a kind of assessment of body language and tone. I can confirm it did not end abruptly. It ended in a totally normal way when they had each gotten through all of their points. And I would say it was very businesslike. Each of them recognize that we are at a critical moment in this conflict. They share a common objective, that is for Israel to prevail over Hamas. And they have a different perspective on this operation in Rafah, and they went into some detail on that and had the opportunity really to elaborate each of their respective views in a full-throated way, in the way they always do when President Biden and Prime Minister Netanyahu talk. So in that sense, I would say this call was much like previous calls that the two of them have had. They each agreed to have the teams get together, and then they agreed that the two of them would stay in touch as we go forward.
The White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan taking reporters' questions at the White House. Story from the Washington Post, famine may already be happening in northern Gaza and risks spreading across the besieged enclave, plunging 2.2 million Palestinians into the broadest and most severe food crisis in the world, the globe's leading body on food emergencies said Monday. The new report from a cluster of international organizations and charities known as the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification Initiative, or IPC, outlined a dire situation with up to half the population of Gaza, 1.1 million people, facing catastrophic levels of hunger and starvation between now and July. The most immediately affected areas are in the northern regions, which Israeli forces cut off from the enclave's southern half, and only a trickle of aid has been able to enter. That was from the Washington Post. Today, Jamie McGoldrick, humanitarian coordinator with the Office of the United Nations Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process, held a virtual news conference from Jerusalem, getting a question from AP reporter Jamie Keaton.
Obviously, you've seen the IPC findings today in the World Food Program comments about famine being imminent. And I just wanted to try to find out specifically what can be done to avert that eventuality. I know that you kind of touched upon this, but if that was your priority number one for North Gaza, what can be done to avert that eventuality? And if I could just add in, what could you describe a little bit about how it works with the Israeli authorities? I mean, are they changing the goalposts? Are they giving you like extremely difficult criteria to be able to ship food in from Israel proper? Just can you kind of give us a description as to what they're telling you is preventing the shipment of food in particular and water into North Gaza? Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot. The IPC mentions that famine is imminent if the steps are not taken. But I would also say that for a lot of young children there, especially the under twos who have shown some serious signs of malnutrition, dehydration, and anemia in pregnant mothers and new mothers, I think that the damage to the development potential of a lot of these young people has probably been affected and something they might never ever recover from and reach their full potential. But I think that what can be done is what should be done is that we have to open up the gates of all roads and all possibilities to get food in from Ashdod into the north, to use the military road, the middle road, and to use the coast road to expand the possibilities of private sector in as well, so that we can get back to close to the 500 trucks a day we need rather than the 200 or so we have at the moment. Unless we can put significant supply increases into those areas, those people who are at catastrophic levels of malnutrition or food insecurity will face real serious problems. And imminent death if that's not the case. We have to have, and it's not just food, it's health support, it's water, it's nutritional targeting, especially of vulnerable groups like some young children. In terms of the Israeli authorities, we've started to work with them to, as you can see, we've got one road, new road opened up, the military road, and we're trying to encourage them to allow us to get the middle road, the Sakhladin road. And it's only through those discussions that we can assure ourselves of getting more food into the north. And then at the same time, we have to find ways of expanding the entry point of goods into Kerem Shalom. Kerem Shalom is the only avenue we have right now of bringing food directly in from the outside, from Rafah, from elsewhere, Amman, into Gaza. And it's significantly not enough. The scanning capacity is only up to 200, 300 trucks a day. So we have to find ways of expanding that or getting alternatives. The alternatives are Ashdod and in Allenby in Jordan, where you can use Israeli scanners, can use those to inspect the trucks and then send them in directly without having to come round through Kerem Shalom again. And that's the way we have to move.
Jamie McGoldrick, UN Humanitarian Coordinator, Office of the UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process, in a virtual news conference today from Jerusalem. Story from Reuters: a day after securing a new six-year term, Russian President Vladimir Putin appeared briefly at an open-air concert on Red Square on Monday to mark the 10th anniversary of Russia's annexation of Crimea from Ukraine. The annexation of the Black Sea Peninsula was a precursor to Moscow's seizure of four other Ukrainian regimes in 2022. That it has declared parts of Russia in actions condemned as illegal by most countries at the United Nations. Putin told a large flag-waving crowd that the return of those other regions to Russia had turned out to be much more grave and tragic than Crimea's, but it had been accomplished. Putin was declared the winner of Russia's presidential election on Sunday with more than 87% of the vote, extending his rule, which began in 1999, until 2030. Back to the White House and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan.
Nothing about the election outcome was unpredictable because Putin had closed the political space, had locked up political opponents. Some of his political opponents had tragically died. And so there was nothing free or fair about this election, and the outcome was preordained. Second, the reality is that President Putin is the president of Russia. We've had to deal with that reality throughout the war in Ukraine, throughout the other aggression Russia has undertaken, throughout the other steps contrary to U.S. national interest that we have seen from this president and from the Russian Federation under his leadership. And we will continue to deal with that reality. But that reality doesn't deny the fact that this election was not something that met any kind of benchmark of being free or fair.
White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan in the White House briefing room. He was also asked about President Putin saying on Sunday at a news conference that he had approved an idea to exchange opposition leader Alexei Navalny for certain people held in penitentiary facilities in Western countries on the condition that Navalny would not return to Russia and that Navalny died in prison before the swap could be carried out, or as President Putin put it, but unfortunately, whatever happened, happened. Here again is Jake Sullivan.
Vladimir Putin in a press conference spoke about a possible Navalny prisoner swap. He said he claimed they'd agreed to exchange Navalny for prisoners in the West on the condition that Navalny never come back to Russia. Can you speak to this? Was there any plan in place?
We have spoken to Russian officials over the course of months and years with respect to American detainees who are unjustly being held in Russia. We have not heard a Russian official raise Navalny as part of a prisoner swap in any of those conversations. So if this is something they were interested in, it certainly sounds like they're coming to it quite late. In fact, too late, obviously, since he's no longer alive, because we did not hear that from them before.
National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan in the White House briefing room. Story from The Hill: a group of Florida Republicans is asking President Biden to allow the Navy to conduct maritime interdictions and interceptions of migrants fleeing from Haiti amid the unfolding chaos in the country. Florida Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz, Gus Bilirakis, Ana Paulina Luna, and Daniel Webster all signed the letter sent to Biden calling on him to declare an anticipated mass migration of aliens en route to or arriving off the coast of the United States. They reference an executive order signed by former President George W. Bush to address illegal migration in the Caribbean region. That was from The Hill. An update today from the State Department Deputy Spokesperson Vedant Patel on U.S. government efforts to help Americans in Haiti who want to get out.
On Sunday, March 17th, the department facilitated the safe departure of over 30 American citizens on a U.S. government charter flight from Cap Haitien, Haiti, to Miami International Airport. As you all know, that the Haiti has been at a level 4 do not travel state since March of 2020. U.S. citizens should not travel to Haiti, and those in Haiti should depart immediately using commercial or other private transportation options when available and safe to do so.
Well, okay, but are there more flights planned?
This is we're taking this process step by step, Matt. This is a fluid and quickly evolving situation on the ground. We are continually staying in touch with American citizens and those who may either be interested in hearing from embassy operations or interested in potential assistance in departing, and we'll be in touch with them should additional measures materialize. But I don't have any updates to offer at this moment.
And then on
right
the
now.
Political situation and the agreement that the secretary helped broker last week, beginning of last week.
So it is it is not hyperbole to say that this is one of the most dire humanitarian situations in the world. Gang violence continues to make the security situation in Haiti untenable, and it is a region that demands our attention and action. I understand that Haitian stakeholders are very close to finalizing membership and remain in active discussions with CARICOM leaders as it relates to the makeup of the Transitional Presidential Council. I expect them to have an update hopefully as soon as today, and refer you to them and CARICOM. But the announcement of this council, we believe, will help pave the way for free and fair elections and the deployment of the multinational security support mission. And the TPC's goal is to work for and improve the lives of all Haitians. And we're seeing gang members do the exact opposite.
State Department Deputy Spokesperson Vedant Patel. From Associated Press, the Pentagon is working with Niger officials to find a way for U.S. troops to stay in the country, a key base for counterterrorism operations in sub-Saharan Africa, following a weekend directive that they leave. Last week, a high-level delegation of U.S. officials traveled to Niger to meet with members of the military junta. Pentagon Deputy Press Secretary Sabrina Singh said Monday the U.S. officials had lengthy and direct discussions with the junta officials that were also in part spurred by concerns over Niger's potential relationships with Russia and Iran. That from Associated Press. And from the New York Times, Secretary of State Antony J. Blinken warned on Monday that a malicious flood of disinformation was threatening the world's democracies, fueled in part by the swift rise of artificial intelligence, which he says sows suspicion, cynicism, and instability around the globe. Mr. Blinken spoke in Seoul at the Summit for Democracy, a global gathering organized by the Biden administration, which has made countering the authoritarian models of nations like Russia and China a top priority. That article from the New York Times, here's Secretary Blinken.
The use of technology, particularly when it comes to digital technologies, social media, and now artificial intelligence, they're dramatically accelerating what had already been an incredibly fast pace of change. But that accelerant has also created an accelerant for disinformation, fueling polarization, adding to the general sense of confusion that people have about the world around them. During COVID, disinformation discouraged millions from getting vaccinated, with sometimes fatal results. Hashtags like climate scam have inundated online platforms, helping to delay action on the climate crisis. Nearly half the people of the world are going to be going to the polls this year. This is an extraordinary election year in country after country. But citizens and candidates will face a flood of falsehoods that suffocate serious civic debate. Our competitors, our adversaries, are using disinformation to exploit fissures within our democracies by further sowing suspicion, cynicism, instability, pitting one group against another, discrediting our institutions. People within our own societies have exacerbated these dynamics, sometimes deliberately, sometimes influenced by bots and algorithms that are trained on biased information. This distortion of the marketplace of ideas is not an unfortunate byproduct of free speech. It's a direct threat to freedom of expression itself. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights enshrines not only the right to express ourselves, it protects our freedom, and I quote, to hold opinions without interference. The manipulation of information undermines our ability to exercise that fundamental right.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken at the Third Summit for Democracy in Seoul, South Korea. Story from the New York Post. Buckingham Palace was forced to deny reports that King Charles III died on Monday after Russian media ran wild with reports based on a dubious-looking announcement. The statement, dated March 18th and featuring the seal of the British monarch's official London residence, said the following announcement is made by Royal Communications. The king passed away unexpectedly yesterday afternoon. The palace issued a statement to the Russian state-run TASS news agency denying the report. We are happy to confirm that the king is continuing with official and private business, it read. The 75-year-old British king has been undergoing treatment for cancer since late January. That from the New York Post. And thanks for listening to Washington Today. Subscribe to C-SPAN's free evening newsletter, Word for Word, and you'll get the stories making headlines in Washington sent to your inbox every day. Sign up at cspan.org/connect. Have a good night.